So we're continuing the series this morning called Origin Stories, and I want you to turn your Bible to Matthew chapter 2, where we're going to pick up the story that's read every year at Christmas about how Herod killed a whole bunch of babies. Merry Christmas. I don't know that this passage, I don't think I've ever taught this passage for one. I don't know that you hear it read very often. I think in the liturgy it might actually come after Christmas because it has to do with the wise men. So what I want to do is I want to tap our collective Sunday school knowledge, and you tell me the story up to verse 12, all right? Tell me the story. What's the story that gets us up to the massacre of the innocents, as it's called? The three wise men, yes. Good. So he could go worship him as well. Yes. So just so you all hear it over here from April, the wise men have visited Herod, said, hey, where the star thing, where's the baby? Herod's like, I don't know, but when you find him, let me know so that I can worship him as well. And the wise men have a vision and decide not to tell Herod, and that's about where we pick up the story in verse 13. So if you look down at verse 13, I'm reading out of the message. Here it goes. After the scholars were gone, God's angel showed up again in Joseph's dream and commanded, get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. Stay until further notice. Herod is on the hunt for this child and wants to kill him. Joseph obeyed. He got up, took the child and his mother under cover of darkness. They were out of town and well on their way by daylight. They lived in Egypt until Herod's death. This Egyptian exile fulfilled what Hosea had preached. I called my son out of Egypt. Herod, when he realized that the scholars had tricked him, flew into a rage. He commanded the murder of every little boy 2 years old and under who lived in Bethlehem and in its surrounding hills. He determined that age from information he'd gotten from the scholars. That's when Jeremiah's sermon was fulfilled. A sound was heard in Ramah, weeping and much lament, Rachel weeping for her children, Rachel refusing all solace, her children gone, dead and buried. Later, when Herod died, God's angel appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, up, take the child and his mother and return to Israel. All those out to murder the child are dead. Joseph obeyed. He got up, took the child and his mother, and re-entered Israel. When he heard, though, that Archelaus had succeeded his father Herod as king in Judah, he was afraid to go there. But then Joseph was directed in a dream to go to the hills of Galilee, and on arrival, he settled in the village of Nazareth. This move was a fulfillment of the prophetic words, he shall be called a Nazarene. So, thoughts, comments, what do you see in the passage? What's interesting or absurd? Another Joseph that God is speaking to through dreams. I'd never put that together. Good. Yeah. Can I just say there's a lot of like play on the Exodus here. So that Joseph idea, Jesus coming out of Egypt, the slaughter of little boys, all of it, like we're supposed, all our, you know, Jewish bells are supposed to be ringing here. Yeah. Just that, yeah, the Herod of the Bible is a terrible, terrible person. And we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about Herod in just a couple minutes. Yeah. Good. Yeah, so Matthew's gospel, just so you know, is super Jewish in its orientation. He's writing to a Jewish audience. And so he does a lot with, like, this is a continuation of that story. He does more work than any other gospel writers to let us know that this story is that story continuing. Good. Yeah, Vicky. All right. Yeah, so what Vicky said is after God pronounces to Mary, after that, all the communications are to Joseph. I don't want to make any conclusions from that. Let's talk about something else. Yeah. So this is the world that they live in. They live in fear of their leaders. Absolutely. So let's do something fun. Let's just do a. How many kids died here? In your imagination, just how many? A lot? 100? Thousands? 2,000? Well, what the text says is the reason that it's 2 and under is Herod had calculated that the wise men came later, and he had calculated, oh, this kid could be anywhere from 2 and under, so I get it. All right, so let's do this. If you were a Byzantine, their liturgy said that there's 14,000 victims in this massacre of the innocents. If you were early Syrian, that number grew to 64,000. Coptic Christians elevated the number to 144,000. This is serious stuff, right? I wanted to point at something, by the way. When we're dealing with ancient literature, this is how it goes. It starts with an actual event, maybe. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. It starts with something, and then somebody adds something to it, and somebody's like, well, no, it had to be this number. And somebody says, oh, no, 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 it had to be this number. Which is funny, because historically speaking, there was about 1,000 residents of Bethlehem at this time. So think about, if you have 1,000 residents, how many baby boys do you have that are under two? About six. Extrapolating the population, it was somewhere between 6 and 20 victims, and maybe another dozen in the rural areas around Bethlehem. Okay? So that is not to say that it's okay, right? That's not to say like, if it was just like a dozen kids, that's fine. It's still bad, okay? But I want us to just be careful sometimes when we're doing this kind of work, that we don't exaggerating the story to make a point doesn't help us. And it actually probably leads us into some bad places. This is, by the way, just as how the legend continues to grow. This is Peter Paul Rubens' Massacre of the Innocents. That makes it look really dramatic. And then a couple years later, he's like, whoa, 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 I better paint it again. Equally as dramatic. So then the question arises about this story. I came across this a couple years ago because I just grew up with like, well, this is history. This is what happened. And it came across, I was doing some studying and came across this passage, and questions started to arise for me about whether this passage did it actually even happen? The only record we have of this event is Matthew. He's the only person who talks about this. So there was a Roman Jewish historian at the time, and his name was Josephus. And Josephus is actually really good at recording all the bad things Herod did. Like Josephus kind of, it's like a hobby of his, is to report all the people that Herod had killed, including like 40 priests, and we're going to see several of his wives because, you know, and his own children, which is great. So Herod wasn't afraid to kill people. That wasn't his thing. Somehow Josephus never mentions this event. And nobody else ever mentions this event that's so bad. And so some people have speculated that Matthew includes this in his gospel because he's doing work to try to tell us that this story is that story and help us understand prophecy. So here's the deal. Did it really happen? Can I take a poll real fast? How many of us think this event really happened just as it is? How many of us are like, maybe not? About half and half. We don't care. All right? For this series, if you remember, for those of you that weren't here this fall, we've been doing this series called Origin Stories. And what we've been saying about all these stories is it doesn't really matter to me which side you believe. The question that we have this morning, the thing we're trying to get after, is why does this story exist? Why is this story in the Bible? And even if it's not factual, even if there wasn't an event where 6 to 12 kids were killed, even if it didn't happen that way, why did Matthew include it? And why are we still talking about this story over 2,000 years later? And I want to say to you before we dig into this is that I think it's more than just, hey, it's part of the Christmas story and it's part of like Herod's a bad guy. Yeah, but I think it's trying to say something to us. So let's spend a little bit of time with Herod. This is a picture of Herod. I don't think this is an actual picture of Herod. What do you all know about Herod? Let's start there. What do you know about Herod? Besides bad guy, somebody said bad guy already. King of the Jews. Yeah. King of prophecy. I don't know what that means. Okay, that's fine. Do we know anything else about Herod? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. He's an Idumean. Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of the messiness of this era. So let's say some things about Herod. Herod's father's name is, Antipater is his father's name. In 47 BC, Julius Caesar... can I back up a little bit more? Remember last week when we talked about Alexander the Great? What happened when Alexander the Great died? He split his kingdom into four groups. The Ptolemies, the Seleucids, and the two others that are over in Greece and Turkey, all right? So the Ptolemies are in Egypt, the Seleucids are in Palestine. Palestine kind of is in right at this crossroads where these two groups are fighting all the time. In the, about 150 BC, the Maccabees come about. Remember the Maccabees and the Christmas armadillo. The Maccabees are this group that they get popular support and they defeat the Seleucids and they set up their own dynasty called the Hasmonean dynasty. And there's this really brief period where they are self-governing. They get to be in charge of themselves. The Greeks aren't there anymore. We are self-controlling, which is a really big deal, right? If we had been under the oppression of the Canadians for a long time, it would feel really good to be like, hey, we get to make our own laws. We get to do what we want. And then the Romans come along and conquer. But when the Romans conquer, they don't, like, you aren't automatically like, you're in Rome now. You're in the Roman Empire, and we are going to allow you to continue to self-govern as long as you don't make a mess of it, as long as you're not being a pain in the butt about it, which they were, which is going to be part of the problems that we'll get to, okay? But that's the idea, is they're in the Roman Empire, but they're not exactly Romans exactly. And so in that fuzzy space, I like it, you know, like it's a fuzzy space of self-rule to the degree that Rome is cool with you. So in 47, Julius Caesar has Antipater and makes him he's in charge of this area. I don't think they called him king yet. And he decides, like, I need two people, one to run Judea and one to kind of oversee Galilee. Who can I get? Oh, my two sons. And so he appoints his two sons. His younger son is, I believe it's the younger son is Herod, and Herod is the ruler then of the region of Galilee. Well, like shortly after that, Julius Caesar dies, and Herod ingratiates himself to Crassus. So he gets in good with the next Roman emperor, and at the same time, he marries this woman called Mariamne, who is a Herodian princess. And so think about this politically. What he just did politically, he had a really good year in 46. He gets in good with the emperor at Rome, and then tightens his connections with the Jews here. And so he's in a really, really good spot. And that works for well for a couple years, about 6 years. And then there's this rival Hasmonean clan, and they take over the throne, and Herod has to flee to Rome. And when he gets to Rome, he becomes buddies with Mark Antony and Octavius. Do these rings ring a bell? So Mark Antony becomes a Caesar. He's good with him. And then Octavian becomes Caesar, and Octavian eventually changes his name to Augustus, very good. I heard that somewhere, maybe. Nice, well played. Octavian becomes Augustus, and Augustus Caesar really likes Herod. And so Herod says, hey, I'd like to go back home and conquer the Parthians and take the throne and be the king of the Jews. And Octavian's like, great, I'll help you. So they do that. And so for a couple years, they wage a war. And in 37 BC, Herod becomes the king of Judea. So all the green there, and then eventually, after that, he pushes up into the north. But basically, eventually, all the green area is under Herod the Great. The orange there, Decapolis, anybody know what Decapolis means? Ten cities, well done. It means 10 cities or 10 Roman cities. And that area sees itself as we are straight up Roman Empire here. The green is kind of this fuzzy middle space, which is important to understand all the time when we're reading the Gospels. It's this fuzzy middle space. The orange is clearly we are Romans through and through. So let's see. What else do we need to know about Herod? Let me do a couple things. Herod was known for his building projects. He did a lot to make the people happy. So the most famous one is if you look up the coast, see the where it says Mediterranean and there's the double R? Look straight right of that and it says Caesarea. Herod basically built this town from the ground up. And it was a beautiful city. It was a trading post. It brought wealth into Judea. I've heard conflicting reports. Some people think that he was oppressive to the poor. Other people say that he lowered the tax rates. He did a lot of things that are kind of popular, but he's at least, at the minimum, a polarizing ruler because of all the other stuff that goes on. But one of his other famous building projects behind Caesarea is he remodels the temple. And this is an artist rendering remodel, it's not to scale. It's an artist's model. It's a model, that's what it is, of the temple. And so you can kind of see an idea of what he did there in outlying Jerusalem. So that was a big deal. A couple other things about Herod. I want to introduce you to his family. So this is a bust of Herod. I told you, his first wife's name was Doris. And her son was Antipater III. He killed them because he thought they were going to take over his power. And if you're doing the crossword puzzle, like I do every Sunday, New York Times crossword puzzle, and you're looking for the word that describes when you kill your wife, anybody? Anybody? You're going to be smarter now. It's uxoricide. That seems like something I'm going to have to learn someday because it's going to come up in a crossword puzzle. You're welcome. Then I told you his second wife is Mariamne. And she has two sons by him named Alexander and Aristobulus. And bye. Then he marries Mary on May the 2nd. So here's what I'm thinking. If you kill your wife and you marry another one, and then you're like, you know, I don't know what your name really is, but I'm going to call you Mary on May the 2nd. You can't feel good. Remember So I Married an Ex-Murderer? It's a lot like that, right? Like, I'm next. And you know what? She actually does, she's part of a plot with Philip to overthrow his throne. But apparently he'd softened by this time in his life, so he just divorces her, and her father was the priest in the temple. So he takes her father out of the priesthood, but he doesn't kill her, lucky her. And then he has a couple other wives who are mostly important in this story because these sons, do you remember any of these names? We read one of them just a little bit ago. Archelaus becomes the king in place of his father. So when Herod dies, his kingdom is split up in Antipas, Archelaus, and Philip, one of the Philips, I think it's Philip the First, divide his up and they make tetrarchs, little individual areas. And those Herods come up again in the trial of Jesus. They come up again in Paul's writings. We see these Herods in other places in the Bible as well. All right? So let me do this, and then I'll get to the stuff that's relevant to us. Here's Herod the Great in summary. He was loved by the Romans. So, like, when we say, by the way, the Bible makes him out to be this utter villain, and that's true. He's a bad guy, but he's loved by the Romans. He's polarizing to the populace because he terrorizes them, but he builds them really nice things. And there's a good economic boon during his administration. So there's good, so there's prosperity, there's building projects. He's super, super political. Everything he does is calculated. Who he marries, how he does, like everything he does is super political. And here's what I want you to understand, this last line. You just do what you have to do. Whatever it takes to get power, whatever it takes to get stuff done the way you want it to get done, you do what you have to do, which brings us back to our passage. And I want to suggest that when we start looking at the Gospels, we need to understand that the Gospels are always, always, always painting on a background. So if I held up a newspaper article, this is from the New York Times on Friday, and there is this person, I'm just going to show you real quick. It looks like this, all right? Can you see that from all the way to the back? And I say, the name of the article is Why I Can No Longer Call Myself an Evangelical Republican. So I want you, like, real quick, what's behind all this? I'm showing you a picture, and I'm showing you a title. What's he talking about? Roy Moore. And do I need to say more? Sorry. That wasn't even funny. I don't, right? Because you all have been reading the news, you all know what's going on. I don't need to explain the context that leads a writer. You know what he's going to say in this article, right? You have a good idea. When I read the headline to you and show you the picture, you have a pretty good idea of what this is going to be about. There's a whole lot of information you're bringing to that exchange right there. As soon as I held this up and read the thing, there was a file in your brain that you just went, everything I know or read this week or the last couple weeks, boom, right there. Correct? The same thing happens in the Gospels whenever they say Herod, whenever they say Rome, whenever they put a location place in, whenever they give us details, we should be digging to try to understand what are they doing? Why are they including these details? They are always writing against a backdrop. And so one of the challenges for us is if I just held this article up, we don't need to go out and do a lot of research. Now, maybe some of you just got on your phones and looked up Roy Moore because you've had your head in the sand all week, and that's fine. But most of you probably didn't have to do that. The problem is when it's 2,000 years later, anybody? You need to do the stuff I just talked about. You need to spend time understanding, like, well, if he's going to mention Herod, like, who is Herod? And why is Herod such a big deal? And then to go to the question we're asking, like, and why does this story matter? Well, one reason is it could just be this. It could just be that it's the fulfillment of prophecy. And that's the way I was always taught, and that might be where you are, and that's fine. But I want to suggest to you this morning that if we scratch a little bit more, it actually is saying something quite a bit more than just Jesus is the fulfillment of prophecy. And I think that what this passage is trying to do, as many passages in the Gospels are trying to do, is to pit Jesus versus Herod. To say, this is what Herod is like. This is what a kingdom of Herod looks like. Slaughter the babies, versus this is what the kingdom of Jesus looks like. One of the questions that they're asking or answering this time, the Romans love to answer this question. The Romans saw themselves as a civilization that was changing the world. They saw themselves as like, we are the pinnacle of everything so far. They didn't use these words, but another country that we won't name used the words a city set upon a hill. Manifest destiny. We have a reason for being in the world, and we're going to impose that on the world. So that when Rome came in, they called this, by the way, we've talked about this a lot. They called this what? The Pax Romana. And we've said many times in this room before, Pax Romana always came at the end of a sword. You will do what we want you to do. And what they, in the minds of Rome, that was okay, because on the other side of it, you get to be a part of us. It sounds nothing like Americans coming to these lands and saying to Native Americans, we don't care what we do to you, we don't care what treaties we violate, we don't care what kind of violence we impose upon you, because you'll be lucky to be more European at the end, right? There's no similarities between us and the Romans, correct? But that's the idea here. So they're having these conversations all the time about how is the world changed? And for Rome, that answer is violence. For Herod, that answer is, how do I change the world? I change the world by violence if I have to. And I change the world by building things. And I change the world by power and strength and letting people know who I am. They call the temple that he remodeled the Herodian temple, right? Remember last week we were talking about Alexander? What did Alexander do everywhere he went? He built cities and named them Alexandria, of course. Herod's doing all the same stuff because that's what it means. That's how you change the world. Except that when Jesus comes into this, the gospel writers, what they're doing is they're holding up Jesus to that and saying, this is what Herod is, this is what Rome is, and here's Jesus. And what we're supposed to see, I think, in all of this, is we're supposed to see how those two things are offering different answers to the question, how has the world changed? The one says the world is changed by might and power and being impressive. And the other one says, is like, blessed are those who mourn. Love your enemies. Do good to those who persecute you. Pray for those. Right? It's a clash of ideas about how the world has changed. It's not just a story about how bad Herod is. These stories, the Gospels are full of these stories about the collision of ideals and philosophies and visions for what it means to change the world, what kingdoms look like. I think that what happens right at this point, and I'll tell you where my bailout all the time is my bailout all the time is I get to points like this, and I've told myself for much of my Christian life and my pastoral life, like, oh, but I don't want to get political. Like, let's not get political about this because politics doesn't belong in the church. And over the last couple years, I've really struggled with this because the problem for me is this, is that whenever I read the Gospels are deeply political documents. Paul is deeply political. Almost everything Paul writes is a critique of Roman Empire. Almost every story that the gospel writers includes is some kind of a critique or some kind of a send-up of the culture they lived in and talking about why the Jesus way is more significant, better, more worthwhile than the politics and the systems of their day. And for much of my career, I've gotten right to that point and said, oh, but we can't be political here. And I guess I'm just getting to a point where this idea here, that if we don't feel political tensions while reading the Gospels, we just aren't reading deeply enough. If you don't walk out of this room sometimes, maybe most times, and feel some kind of like angst about your politics, then I've probably failed you as a pastor to explain it clearly enough, because the Bible's always talking about our politics. Now, I don't mean when I say that Republican versus Democrat or independent or Bernie versus, I don't know who Bernie's against, everybody, I guess. That's not what I'm talking about. But what I'm talking about is I love the definition of Rob Bell, who said, politics is our shared life together. It's our shared life together. It's whether the money that I give the government, does that go to funding wars in various places in the world? that's our shared life together. We all put money in the pot, and people get to choose how to spend that money. That's our shared life together. I would like water at my house when I turn on the tap, right? Anyone? That's our shared life together. Somebody's got to make those decisions about how we're going to get clean water. Those decisions have to be made. That's our shared life. That's politics. I said all this last year when we started talking politics, but I want to point at where this actually plays out. I'm going to use this example, and I know it might ruffle some feathers, and I'm sorry. Well, no, I'm not. I know it's going to ruffle some feathers. That's fine. It's Alabama, not us, all right? But it illustrates something. So this week, Roy Moore has been in the news, right? So for those of you that aren't paying attention to the news, Roy Moore is a Republican senatorial candidate from the great state of Alabama. He has been accused by 9 women now of dating them, being sexually inappropriate. I'll leave it there with girls when they were still teenagers, one as young as, I believe, 12. 14, okay? That is what it is. We've seen that a lot over the last couple weeks, right? And that I think all of us have just been so disillusioned by men in power. I'll tell you where I'm disillusioned. I was having lunch with a friend this week, and we were talking about stuff, and he was asking me things, and I was like, where I'm most disillusioned these days is that the majority of evangelical Christians in Alabama still back this guy. They're verbally throwing their support, and also outside of Alabama, are verbally throwing their support at this person who, from what I read of scriptures and what I know of Herod, acts more like Herod than Jesus, from what I can tell. He's not killing people, but he's doing a lot of really awful things. So then there was this pushback this week, and there's been the pushback. That's what this article is about. It's, by the way, a really good article written by a guy who's like, I'm a lifelong Republican, I'm a lifelong evangelical, and I'm not abandoning either any of my ideals. I'm not abandoning my conservatism. I just don't think this is what it looks like. And I'm like, props to you, dude. So this is a check written by another Republican from Arizona named Jeff Flake. And do you see what it says in the memo line? What does it say? Country over party. Amen? Amen. I mean, for many of us, right? Here's what I think the Bible's pushing us to, is that's not enough. Country over party isn't what Christians, that's not our rallying cry. And if we think it is, we've somehow lost our way. I would suggest that what the Gospels are always calling us to is kingdom over absolutely everything. Kingdom over country, over party, over anything else you have. That these stories aren't just like, I say it all the time, these stories aren't like cute little baby Jesus stories. They aren't like, oh, look at all the animals in the manger scene, and there was animals there, and Jesus, and it was a silent night, and it was all like pristine and good. These stories are supposed to rattle us a little bit. These stories are supposed to challenge us a little bit. These stories are here because they're supposed to cause us to question our politics and ask about those places in my life where I've put country, or I've put party, or I've put whatever affiliations here above kingdom, because the call of the Gospels always is to abandon it all for following the kingdom of Jesus. Blessed are the poor, blessed are the meek, blessed are the persecuted. And that should challenge us and rock us to our core. This is especially apropos this week. The Advent theme on the second week of Advent is peace, right? Probably no area in my growth as a Christian has like this idea of peace and the gospel. I remember the first time somebody came to me when I was in my second or third year of ministry at the church in Pekin, and this guy in my church and I would often read books together, and he came to me and we were reading Yoder's The Politics of Jesus, and he told me that, he challenged me. He's like, how can you call yourself a Christian and not be a pacifist? And I was like, get out of my office, or I'll punch you. kidding, I didn't punch him or kick him out of my office, but I was kind of offended. And yet I find myself deeply challenged by those ideas today, that maybe no spot do I ever get more like feel the tension of the Gospels and the tension of Jesus saying, follow my way, the person who said, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, never is that more in tension when we start talking about immigration and where we should go to war. I'm not telling you how you should vote or who you should vote for. I'm just saying that it ought to rattle us a little bit and ought to cause us to have hard conversations. And it might cause us in our marriages and our friendships to have conversations that are a little bit uncomfortable. Where'd Masters go? Is he in here? Eric Masters and I and Emily sat at Donnelly's, last week on a Wednesday night? And we argued with each other hard for like an hour about this kind of stuff, about politics and where's my call to be a Christian conflicting with my politics and what do you do in this circumstance? And it should cause some tension. And I went home that night like gears turning, like, man, good, hard conversation. And so here's the thing, and I'll end here and we'll move to communion. I don't want you to walk away this morning and just say then, oh, Charlie gave a message about politics again. But rather, there's probably a deeper place to push ourselves. This isn't just about what you think about Roy Moore. I don't care, and I really don't need to have conversations afterwards about what you think about Roy Moore. Doesn't matter to me. Rather, the question is that philosophy of Herod, you do what you have to do, where is that interfacing with my actual life? Where are the ethics of Jesus challenging me to live in a way that's different than what the culture says about a whole lot of things, about how we use our money and how we use our power and how we use our privilege and how I treat the people that work for me or how I treat the people that pick up my garbage or the person that checks me out? What is the politics of Jesus? What is the Sermon on the Mount way of living calling me to do that's different than what our culture says is acceptable and good and shows that we are who we are? And I hope that rattles us. I hope it rattles me. Let's pray. Forgive us, forgive me, God, where those moments when I've been more American or Republican or more myself, or whatever it is, than what you're calling us to be. Forgive us where we have dismissed your words, Jesus, because we don't want to get political, when you're calling us to think and live in ways that are radically different than our culture. Thank you for these writers who are always playing with those ideas and pushing us to think about Jesus in ways that are different than Herod, different than Rome, different than the religions of his day, and keep pushing us in the same categories to think differently about empire and country and even religion when we need to. And then thank you, Jesus, that wherever we fall on our own political divides, and I know that those aren't easy answers, and some of us fall on political divides all over the place, thank you that there's one table. And that when we walk down this aisle today, we're brothers and sisters in Christ, and that we may engage in really hard conversations, and we may push back, and we may argue. But at the end, we all come to the same table, and we worship you in earnestness with all of our strength and all of our soul and all of our mind. In your name I pray.